Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 18th, 2022 Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today, I'll be reading the following main articles. Legislature, wider union rates unlikely, by Alex Burness of the Denver Post. DIA, auditor, vendor contracts are unfair, by Joe Rubino of the Denver Post. And hospitalizations, rates could fall to levels of summer lull by March, by Meg Wingerter of the Denver Post. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our first story today, legislature, wider union rights unlikely. Governor opposes including city school workers in any bill, by Alex Burness. Labor leaders in Colorado entered this legislative session thinking, or at least hoping, they would get the Democrat-controlled legislature to pass a bill empowering more than 250,000 public sector workers with new union rights. That sort of policy would make national headlines and would mark the most substantial gain for organized labor in this state in years, if not decades. It's now clearer than ever that such a measure is highly unlikely. Over this week and last, the Denver Post interviewed more than 15 people with knowledge of the negotiations around this not-yet-introduced bill and gleaned new specifics about how this would be landmark proposal stands to be neutered. The basic idea behind the bill is to grant public workers the right to unionize and to bargain collectively over wages, benefits, and working conditions. Some public workers, including the majority of Colorado educators, already have this right, but many thousands do not, and that's why labor leaders are seeking a statewide policy that lets every public sector workplace form a union without needing employer recognition, then sets out baseline terms for contract negotiations. A number of headwinds face the bill, including the fact that lobbyists representing public employers across the state are united in opposition and are threatening lawsuits. "We're going to oppose everything," said Kevin Baumer, director of the Colorado Municipal League. Also, although Democrats have a huge majority in the state house, their 20-15 margin in the Senate means sweeping progressive policy must always win over the caucus's more moderate flank, an outcome that is hardly guaranteed in this case. But most importantly, many sources told the Post that Governor Jared Polis, whose signature is needed to turn a bill into law, is not interested in including workers who work for cities, school districts, or special districts. That alone would lop off the vast majority of the public sector. "The governor conveyed to me that he is comfortable including county workers and higher education," Josette Jaramillo, president of the Colorado AFL-CIO, told the Post. Several people told the Post that Polis is also loath to grant labor too much power in any provisions of the bill affecting conflict resolution between workers and employers. That means, among other things, that the right to strike is a non-starter, so is binding arbitration. Even on those terms, a bill covering counties, or counties and higher education faculty members both, still would be arguably the most significant pro-labor policy of the governor's first term. In the context of the much greater ask, it's but a narrow reform. Jaramillo spoke of how pained the labor community is by the thought of compromising the bill in that way. "The decision means cutting folks out," she said, "so it's going to be a tough decision to make for the coalition." Lawmakers believe they never could have gotten this far with previous Democratic governors, such as John Hickenlooper and Bill Ritter. In Polis, they have found more of a labor ally, but they're being reminded now of how far his allyship stretches. Polis repeatedly has declined to discuss the matter with reporters. Most labor leaders are a bit more open than he is, but they too are generally unwilling to speak in any detail about the bill. As has often been the case on other big, messy policy matters at the Capitol, the parties involved on this bill have been working to strike a deal behind the scenes to avoid a drawn-out public negotiation. But as Colorado's legislative session chugs along, now about one-third complete, tensions are rising and pressure to choose a path is mounting. A bill of this nature will be very long and detailed. It will be lobbied relentlessly, and it will prompt hours of debate in both chambers. Proponents risk getting nowhere if they wait until late in the 120-day session to take the policy from behind the scenes and into the committee rooms and chambers of the Capitol. That's especially true if they push a bigger bill than works for Polis or moderate Senate Democrats. One of those moderates, Arvada Senator Rachel Zenzinger, said the advocates of the bill are going to have to make a choice. Do we want to go ahead and make this a messaging bill and ask for what we want and think we deserve, or do we chip it down to what we think we can pass and make some progress? Those working on this bill are accustomed to compromising with Polis, a hands-on governor who involves himself closely in legislative affairs, unlike Hickenlooper. It took two sessions, for instance, for Polis and Democratic lawmakers to agree on a bill granting collective bargaining rights to the state workers' union. That bill affected 30,000 people belonging to a single union. So it is unsurprising that this follow-up, which could affect hundreds of thousands more people belonging to many hundreds of different workplaces, is even trickier. The bill has two powerful sponsors, House Majority Leader Danea Escar of Pueblo and Senate Majority Leader, soon to be Senate President, Steve Fenberg of Boulder. In interviews, both seem to have accepted that the bill they want to pass isn't going to happen. Democrats already are seeking to reframe the conversation in the hope that it is not lost on the labor movement, nor on the public at large, that a bill affecting tens of thousands of workers is still a big deal. If we're able to get more rights to more people in Colorado, I'm going to call that a success, Escar said. Added Fenberg, I want to introduce a bill that can pass. I don't want to introduce a bill that's far from reality of what we can get done. Fenberg said he's gotten no red lines from Polis, but added, of the governor's negotiating style, if he makes a statement on where he is on something, he holds pretty strong. I think he comes to those conclusions with a lot of thought. I don't think they're random, off-the-cuff lines in the sand. I don't see him just rolling over. The labor side has wanted this policy for years, and many in that camp want to introduce the all-inclusive version and invite Polis to a public showdown. The alternative is to take what win is available and hope to build from there in future sessions. Alex Wolf Root, an adjunct professor at the University of Colorado and vice president of the Communications Workers of America Local 7799, said he wants to get the big version out in the open. We have to make that push, and we have to try. And if Polis decides he'll be the person to harm our public good and our public workers, at the end of the day, we can't stop that, he said. But just because we know he might be willing doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Amy Baca Olert, president of the State Teachers Union, met with Polis along with leadership from the National Education Association. She said she didn't get a slammed door from Polis, but added, even if there were a slammed door, we're not willing to accept that. Labor leaders and advocates rallied on the Capitol steps last week, a show of force outside the workplace of POLIS and lawmakers. That's a good move, said Senator Faith Winter, a progressive Westminster Democrat who is not involved in this bill, but who in previous session has fought POLIS, the lobby, and her own caucus's moderates on paid family and medical leave policies and on climate action. When you're representing people and ideas that don't have a lot of money behind them, you have to be more creative on bringing energy into the building, she said. The reality, Winter and others noted, is that the usual tactics, rallies, social media campaigns, submitted letters, and columns in newspapers, don't work on POLIS. To negotiate with the governor, you need to be prepared for very steadfast and passionate opinions that are unlikely to change, she said. Asked how to get around that, she said with a laugh, I don't think I've figured it out. Neither has the labor community. The coalition is aware of the governor's position, and time is of the essence, Jaramillo said. We have to make a decision. Are we going to pull it? Are we going to move forward without everyone involved, or move forward as is, fully knowing where the governor stands? DIA, Auditor, Vendor Contracts Are Unfair, by Joe Rubino. Denver International Airport's process for selecting operators for its restaurant, bar, retail, and passenger service locations is not fair, and the incentive program the airport offers concessionaires should be ended, the city auditor says. In a report released Thursday, Denver's elected auditor, Tim O'Brien, said DIA's process of awarding concession contracts may be in violation of an executive order mandating most city contracts be subjected to a competitive bidding process. The airport could be missing out on revenue by failing to select the best contractors for its opportunities, the audit found. They should have grabbed hold of this a long time ago, O'Brien said in a news release accompanying the report. Denver's airport is one of the busiest in the country. With millions of people traveling through, these concessions contracts are highly lucrative. Businesses don't need additional incentives to want to operate there. O'Brien and his staff found that the airport allows some concessionaires to bypass competitive bid processes. DIA's premium concessions program was designed to provide incentives to concessionaires airport officials believe provide value to the airport, per the audit report. But the airport pays an outside firm $500,000 a year to run the incentive program and has never evaluated if it is truly beneficial. There are also multiple elements of the airport's contracting operation that are unfair, including allowing concessionaires on expired contracts to hold over and maintain their spaces. As of August, 40% of active concessions contracts at DIA were holdovers, dating back to at least the end of 2019, according to Thursday's news release. The average length of time the contracts had been expired was more than 5 years, with some going back a dozen years. The airport's practice of destroying score sheets that measure competitive bids for concession opportunities also makes the process opaque and raises further questions about fairness, the auditor's report says. The process also was audited in 2014, and it was recommended at that time that airport officials stop destroying the sheets. The airport's concessions bidding process was at the center of a lawsuit in 2018. That lawsuit alleged, in part, that DIA officials destroyed scoring sheets that showed a contract for four food and beverage locations was given to a lower scoring bidder. The case was dismissed, but refiled in 2019 with additional allegations that the FBI was investigating the bid rigging allegations. That case is still pending in Denver District Court, according to attorney Stephen Long. The auditor's office has provided a list of recommendations for DIA to address the problems it found with the concession contracting process. Ending the incentive program tops the list. The other recommendations include performing a cost-benefit analysis, updating the airport's concessions master plan, reviewing holdover contracts, and updating policies around record keeping. Specifically, the airports should keep scorecards from concessionaires bidding for competitive contracts for 7 years, the auditor's office recommends. I am concerned with how these problems were allowed to go on for so long, O'Brien said in his news release. But I do believe airport officials are receptive to making the necessary changes going forward. I look forward to seeing their progress when we follow up. DIA officials did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Thursday afternoon. Turning now to hospitalizations, rates could fall to levels of summer lull by March, by Meg Wingerter. Colorado could see COVID-19 hospitalizations drop to levels experienced during summer lulls as soon as March, assuming the virus doesn't throw out a new variant that invalidates much of the population's immunity. New cases and hospitalizations have continued to trend down, and Colorado's COVID-19 modeling team projects that as much as 90% of the population may have some immunity by the end of February, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said in a news briefing Thursday. A higher percentage likely are protected from severe disease, even if they get a breakthrough case, she said. We're at very high levels of immunity in the state right now, she said. That's a higher percentage than the state modeling team projected in January, reflecting new knowledge about how long immunity lasts and a greater than expected number of infections in the past few weeks, Herlihy said. As of Sunday, about one in every 69 Coloradans was believed to be contagious. As of Thursday afternoon, 563 people were hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19 statewide, down from a high of 1,676 in January. The state recorded an average of 1,345 cases per day over the past week, which is about one-tenth as many as at the most recent peak, driven by the virus's Omicron variant. Scientists at Johns Hopkins University estimated about three-quarters of all Americans have at least some immunity to COVID-19, although the level of protection varies significantly from place to place. Getting to that level of immunity came with a cost, though. About 2,000 Americans still are dying of the virus each day. In general, healthy people who are up to date on their vaccinations or who survived a COVID-19 infection are unlikely to become severely ill for at least a few months after their last exposure, meaning hospitalizations and deaths should drop through the spring. People with compromised immune systems don't have the same protection, though, and it's not clear how long resistance to severe illness lasts, even in generally healthy people. We've reached a much better position for the coming months, but with waning immunity, we shouldn't take it for granted, said Ali Mokdad, a professor of health metric sciences at the University of Washington. State officials cited the new projections as one of the reasons to deactivate Colorado's crisis standards of care that offered liability protection and guidance to hospitals and ambulance providers if they had to stretch their staffing during the pandemic's fall and winter waves. We've reached a point today where those crisis standards of care are no longer necessary, said Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander. It's still considered a good idea to wear masks in indoor public spaces, but that may no longer be necessary in the near future, Bookman said. He asked people who do not wear masks to show respect for those who continue to do so. Today, disease rates are still quite high, he said. We're moving to a spot of personal choice coming up in March. Colorado's crisis standards of care for medical staffing had been in place since November 9th, when the state's fifth wave was nearing its peak, and the possibility of running out of hospital beds was real. The state put the standards for emergency medical services into place on January 7th, when so many people were out sick with the Omicron variant that it wasn't clear if providers could staff their ambulances. Since then, COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations have dropped to levels last seen in August, although there's still little slack in the system as people seek care that they could not get during previous waves. Staffing shortages remain a problem because some nurses and technicians have left the medical field. Although cases and hospitalizations are expected to remain low through June, it's not clear what will happen later, Herlihy said. That depends on how quickly immunity wanes and whether new variants of the virus are particularly good at evading the immune system, she said. Projecting beyond that gets a lot more challenging, she said. The state is working with hospitals and others to be ready if another surge comes, and they need to scale up testing and other measures to fight the virus, Bookman said. Dr. Eric France, chief medical officer for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, said the crisis standards of care are meant for times of acute crisis, and that's no longer the situation in Colorado. We recognize that healthcare systems continue to face challenges due to chronic staffing issues across the economy, and we thank healthcare workers for their service protecting Coloradans throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, he said in a news release. The state never activated standards that allowed for care rationing, although a team updated them in November in anticipation that some patients might need to be sent home if a bed was not available, or denied the highest level of care if resources were short. A trade group representing Colorado emergency room doctors said it had to limit hospital admissions for a time because of a lack of staffers to care for less severely ill people, although it didn't have to ration treatment for the sickest patients. The emergency medical services standards allowed ambulance crews to limit care in certain circumstances, such as not attempting to resuscitate people who were deemed unlikely to survive. The hospital staffing standards allowed facilities to move staff into areas where they normally don't work, ideally with a more experienced person overseeing them. In the worst-case scenario, they could also ask patients' family members to help with non-medical care, although there haven't been any reports of that. Also on the front page is a photo taken by Aaron Ontiveros of the Denver Post. The headline says, "Ready to Wrestle." And the description says, "Yuma High School girls wrestling coach Brandon Newton prepares 185-pounder Maya Dishner during the first day of the state wrestling tournament at Ball Arena on Thursday. Dishner defeated Lauren Martinez of Pueblo Central by way of a fall in 5 minutes and 19 seconds. It is the first time the girls' tournament has been held at Ball Arena, with 10 weight classes instead of 14 like the boys. And on championship Saturday night, they will get the center mat. Turning to some local briefs, large drug bust in Denver. A Denver man has been charged with multiple felonies in connection with an alleged large-scale drug operation. The 42-year-old defendant faces 30 felony counts for possessing and distributing illegal drugs, including fentanyl, heroin, methamphetamine, and cocaine, along with other charges, according to the district attorney's office. On January 20th, investigators and officers with the Denver Police Department served a search warrant on a residence in the 3600 block of Osage Street, according to a DA's news release. Drugs, cash, and guns were seized, including pounds of suspected methamphetamine, suspected black tar heroin, thousands of suspected fentanyl pills, assault rifles, a shotgun, semi-automatic handguns, and a revolver. Miscellaneous gun parts, including several non-serialized ghost components, thousands of rounds of live ammunition, more than $7,000, ledgers connected to the illegal drug operation, drug packaging, and weight scales also were seized, according to prosecutors. The charges also include possession of a weapon by a previous offender. The defendant's next court date is scheduled for March the 10th, and that was by Kieran Nicholson of the Denver Post. And from the Summit Daily, A-Basin adds 10 electric car charging ports. Arapaho Basin Ski Area has added 10 charging ports for electric cars to its Early Riser parking lot. The ski area received funding from the Xcel Energy EV Readiness Program and the State Energy Office Charge Ahead Grant to cover the cost of purchasing and installing the charging stations. A-Basin skiers can use one of the 10 charging ports, which are at the front of the Early Riser lot, from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. The ports are free for the remainder of the winter season, and they can be accessed using the app ChargePoint, according to a news release. The chargers don't have any time limits, and they can deliver 25 to 30 driving miles per hour. However, ski area officials ask that people move their vehicles once they are fully charged. King Super suspect, state hospital fails to report to court about man's condition, by Shelley Bradbury. The state mental health hospital treating the suspect in the Boulder King Supers mass shooting has failed to report to the court about the man's condition, 20th Judicial District Chief Judge Ingrid Baca wrote in an order Wednesday. She ordered representatives from the Colorado Mental Health Institute at Pueblo to explain their failures, saying the hospital has not filed required reports about the likelihood that treatment could improve suspect Ahmed Al-Aliwi Alisa's mental competency to the point that the criminal case against him could proceed. Alisa, 22, faces more than 100 charges, including 10 counts of first-degree murder, in connection with the March 22nd attack at the Boulder grocery store. The criminal case against him stalled last fall when psychologists found that he was not competent to stand trial. A competency evaluation considers whether a criminal defendant is mentally ill or developmentally disabled, and whether that mental illness impedes the defendant's ability to understand the court process. Competency refers only to a defendant's current mental capacity and is distinct from an insanity defense, which focuses on the defendant's mental state at the time of the alleged crime. Despite failing to meet Baca's requirements for reporting, the hospital has not missed any statutory deadlines for making its initial report on Alisa, said Maria Livingston, interim communications director for the state's Office of Behavioral Health. The department will adhere to its statutory obligations, she said in an email on Thursday. Under state law, a judge must review a case within 91 days of sending a defendant for competency treatment, Livingston said, and the hospital must provide a report 10 days before that review. Baca sent Alisa to the hospital to receive treatment in December, and his review hearing is set for March 15th. A show cause hearing regarding the hospital's reports is scheduled for March the 10th. The state mental hospital is well known for delays and backlogs. As of Wednesday, there were 345 people waiting to be admitted for inpatient competency restoration treatment at the hospital, Livingston said. Many defendants who initially are deemed incompetent receive treatment and are restored to competency within 6 months, experts told the Denver Post. Some cases stall indefinitely, like the case against the man charged with killing three people at a Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood clinic in 2015, who consistently has been found incompetent to proceed since early 2016. Baca initially ordered that Elisa be evaluated for mental competency locally in Boulder rather than at the state hospital because of concern about delays. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Doherty said in a statement Thursday that Baca's order to the hospital is necessary. We want to avoid undue delays and ensure that the defendant receives the treatment required to restore him to competency as soon as possible, he said. 18-year-old patient dies, Greenwood Village plastic surgeon arrested by Kieran Nicholson. A Greenwood Village plastic surgeon has been arrested in connection with the death of an 18-year-old patient. Dr. Jeffrey Kim, 52, turned himself into authorities Wednesday, accompanied by an attorney, according to an Arapahoe County Sheriff's news release. Kim is being investigated for the death of Emma Lynn Wynn. An arrest warrant has been issued for Kim on suspicion of two felonies, first-degree aggravated assault and criminally negligent homicide. On August 1, 2019, Wynn of Brighton underwent breast augmentation surgery at Colorado Aesthetic and Plastic Surgery, the release said. She went into a cardiac arrest after being administered anesthesia, fell into a coma, and died 14 months later. A criminal investigation was then undertaken. We opened this criminal case in August 2019. The investigation has taken more than 2 years to complete and involved dozens of interviews and search warrants. Our hope is that this will be the beginning of bringing justice and a sense of closure to Emma Lynn's family, said Travis Stewart, captain of investigations with the sheriff's office, in the release. Rex Meeker, a nurse anesthetist, is wanted on an arrest warrant for manslaughter, according to the sheriff's office. Formal charges have not yet been filed in the case. Kim was booked and released Wednesday after posting bail. In June, Kim and Meeker each agreed to pay $1 million to the family of Gwen, an attorney for the family told CBS4. Douglas County School Board plans swift search for superintendent by Jessica Seaman. The Douglas County School District's hunt for a new superintendent will be swift, as most members of the Board of Education want to vote on finalists in early March, although they ultimately pushed off approving a timeline until next week. The school board met Wednesday evening to discuss for the first time publicly its plans to search for someone to lead the district, which serves more than 63,000 students. The board fired former Superintendent Corey Wise without cause in a contentious meeting about 2 weeks ago. Members considered a timeline to vote on finalists on February 24th, a week after they posted the job opening, but they decided to wait. Instead, they will consider approving a timeline to vote on finalists on March 3rd during their next meeting. The board also voted unanimously to open up the superintendent's job description for applicants on Thursday, and it will run for 9 days. Board President Mike Peterson and other majority members said they wanted to hire a new superintendent soon to bring stability and unity back to the school district, which is deeply divided on Weiss's firing, COVID-19 policies, and other issues. This is not unprecedented, Peterson said of the timeline. Anyone who would consider being an applicant knows these positions are open. He acknowledged that he has reached out to a potential candidate, the district's former interim superintendent, Erin Kane, several weeks ago and asked if she was willing to apply for the position. Kane, executive director of American Academy, a charter school, said she would, Peterson said. Christy Williams, vice president of the board, supported Kane applying for the superintendent job, saying her children attend the schools that Kane oversees. Do I respect her and think that she could bring value to the district? Williams said, yes, I do. Still others on the board asked that the job opening be posted internally and outside of the district. And the three minority members, Susan Meek, Elizabeth Hansen, and David Ray, questioned how quickly the search is moving. "I have never seen a timeline like this in my life," Meek said before the meeting. "All of that takes months, and this process is a week, essentially." Meek, during the meeting, called Peterson's outreach to Kane unethical. The school board was divided deeply in its decision to fire Weiss, with a 4-3 vote led by the newly elected members of the board. At the time, Peterson said he was worried about having a person selected by the three minority members leading the district. The three minority members alleged, in the days leading up to Weiss's firing, that Peterson and Williams privately told Weiss to resign or be voted out. They also alleged that the other board members violated state open meeting laws. Williams said during the February 4th school board meeting that they did not violate sunshine laws. The allegations and Weiss's firing drew two protests by hundreds of teachers and students, and a lawsuit has since been filed by a Highlands Ranch parent against the four majority members, alleging they violated open meeting laws. All of this has come as the school board is undergoing a shift after four new conservative members were elected in November. They now hold the majority and have moved quickly to implement changes, including lifting the mask mandate for schools. When you have such a shift in the school board makeup after an election, it's pretty common to see the superintendent resign or be fired, said Carrie Sampson, an assistant professor in the Division of Educational Leadership and Innovation at Arizona State University. The district's two deputy superintendents, Andy Abner and Danelle Hyatt, have shared the role of acting superintendent since Weiss's termination. The timeline proposed by the board is shorter than such searches typically take. Districts of similar size to Douglas County School District normally try to recruit more candidates, including outside of the district, Sampson said. For example, it took nearby Denver Public Schools 6 months to confirm Alex Marrero as its new leader after Susana Cordova left the district in 2020. Douglas County's school board meeting, which began at 5 p.m. and ran through midnight, was held remotely because of the snowstorm that hit the metro area late Wednesday. Some students and other community members who spoke during the public comments portion of the meeting raised concerns about how Weiss was fired and how quickly the board is moving to hire a new superintendent. "Your failure to postpone your decision to allow public comment demonstrates that you know the community is not behind you, yet you acted anyway," said Francis Stroud, a senior at Rock Canyon High School, during the meeting. Another person who spoke told the board she supported the decision to replace Weiss. The Denver Post was unable to confirm all speakers' names. "The kids and parents of Douglas County deserve a superintendent who reflects the values of the people of the district," she said. "The voters have spoken, and the new majority should have the ability to choose a superintendent who isn't defiant against the will of parents and voters." There are numerous obituaries in today's Denver Post, so I will read the basics from those. Beth Corinne Barrett, born August 9, 1951, and died February 10, 2022. Beth C. Barrett, born August 9, 1951, passed away on Thursday, February 10, in the presence of her family. She is survived by her beloved husband, Stephen, children, Ryan and Jim, daughters-in-law, Maritza and Wendy, grandchildren, Damaris, Nathalie, Emma and Jimmy, as well as many extended family and friends. A service in celebration of Beth's life will be held at Crossroads Community Center on Huron Street in North Glen at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, February 23rd. A reception will follow. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to Stonecroft Ministries or the Arthritis Foundation. Joseph B. Blake, born December 24, 1935, and died February 15, 2022. He got his Juris Doctorate in 1961 from the University of Colorado School of Law, and later headed to Washington, D.C. to join the FBI. He later was a legislative aide to Colorado Senator Gordon Allott, and it was in the nation's capital that he met Elizabeth Rowland, whom he married in 1964. Upon being named regional administrator for the Federal Office of Housing and Urban Development, the couple returned to Denver to make their home and raise their children, Ann and Joe Jr. His wife Elizabeth, brother Jack, and parents predeceased him. He is survived by his daughter Ann Patterson, son Joe Blake Jr., and grandchildren Ben and Tom Patterson, and Alex and Evan Blake. During the last years of Joe's life, he was blessed to find love and deep friendship with Jean Ann Hattler of Denver and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A memorial service will be held Saturday, June 4th at 2 p.m. at Montview Presbyterian Church in Denver. Gifts in Joe's memory may be directed to the Boy Scouts of America, Judy's House, Montview Presbyterian Church, and the Blake Leadership Scholars at CSU. Leonard D. Mattia, 69, of Denver, Colorado, peacefully passed away while listening to the Grateful Dead after battling brain cancer for more than a year. Born in Queens, New York, he came to Colorado in 1978 to work in the oil exploration industry. He later changed careers, graduating from the Culinary Institute of America in New Hyde Park, New York, in 1991. He specialized in banquets, eventually retiring from the Four Seasons Hotel in 2019. Leonard was predeceased by his parents, Frank and Lillian DeMattia of Massapequa, New York, brother Frank DeMattia Jr., and niece Jenna DeMattia, both of Denver. He is survived by his sister Linda DeMattia Underwood of Castleton, New York, brother Gregory DeMattia of Oak Run, California, niece Kimberly Schneider of Aurora, Colorado, nephew Brant Underwood of Hawthorne, New York, niece Gwen Toporek of Colony, New York, three great-nephews and two great-nieces, one great-great-niece, and many beloved cousins and dear friends. A celebration of Leonard's life will be held at a future date. Donations can be made in Leonard's name to the Denver Homeless Shelter or a charity of your choice. Marjorie May Hunt was born November 8, 1928, and died November 17, 2021. Services and reception on Saturday, February 19, 2022, at 1 p.m. at the Southside Bible Church on Tucson Way in Centennial. Donald Don Lang, born March 16, 1937, and died February 11, 2022. He was a corporal in the Marine Corps. Don, age 84, died at Lutheran Medical Center due to COVID complications. He was born to George Albert Lang Sr. and Ladora Dean Rolas on March 16, 1937, in Denver. He joined the USMC in 1955 and served one tour in Korea. Upon returning home, he married Rosalie Jean Wells on January 29, 1959, and they celebrated 54 years of marriage before her death on July 5, 2013. He is survived by his two children, Donna Ray and Joey Dean, grandson Tyler Jameson House, and great-grandson Oliver Mike House. Funeral services will be held at Fort Logan National Veterans Cemetery on Monday, February 21st at 11 a.m. Maurice Butch Lutwak, born July 29, 1939, and died February 14, 2022. A visitation will be held on February 18th from 10 a.m. to 10:50 a.m., followed by a funeral mass at 11 a.m. at Spirit of Christ Catholic Community on 80th Avenue in Arvada. For the full obituary, you can see HoranCares.com. Manuel Montoya, born September 2, 1931, and died February 2, 2022. He was born in Trinidad, Colorado, to Clarita Lopez and Braulio Sanchez. Joining the U.S. Army on December 2, 1948, he served with ASA, the United States Army Security Agency. In 1954, Manuel was assigned overseas duty to France, and on a three-day weekend pass, he met, married, and promised his wife, Alice Avila Montoya, a life of travel, regular income, and medical care. Manuel retired from the Army in 1970 and worked for the U.S. Post Office until 1990. He and his wife celebrated 60 years of wedded bliss before her passing just a few weeks later. Due to a decline in health, Manuel had been living in the home of his daughter and son-in-law, Ruth Marie Montoya Starr and W. Kurt Starr, and they had remote assistance from daughter Jessica Montoya Starr. There will be a private military honoring service for Manuel Montoya at Fort Logan Cemetery, but there is no gathering at this time out of an abundance of caution due to the coronavirus epidemic. And our final obituary today, Travis J. Musing. On Monday, February 7, 2022, Travis J. Musing passed away at the age of 73 at his home in Goodyear, Arizona. Travis was born February 9, 1948 in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to Harold and Wilma Musing, and he spent his youth in Clarence, Iowa. He worked at several companies in the computer technology field, primarily in Denver, over his career until his retirement in 1999. Travis married Tracy Rutch Coffin on April 14, 1979, and they shared a special life together for 42 years. Travis was preceded in death by his parents and is survived by his wife Tracy, his brothers-in-law Daryl and Scott, brother Garvis, and his beloved nieces and nephews Jason, Allie, Andy, Michael, and Steph. His ashes will be scattered this summer in the Vail Memorial Park in Vail, Colorado. Donations may be sent to the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. And we actually have a few more obituaries because they are on another page, so we will continue with those. Fuji Murakami, born December 21, 1935, and died January 11, 2022. Fuji Murakami passed away at Serenity House in Inglewood on January 11th at the age of 86. She was born in Tokyo but settled in Denver in 1966 and worked for Jaliff's Oriental, a well-known Asian antique store. She is survived by a brother and sister-in-law, two nieces, and several cousins. A memorial service will be held Thursday, February 24th at 1 p.m. at the Haran and McConaughey Chapel, which is located on South Colorado Boulevard in Denver. You can use a link to access live streaming of the service, which you can access via the Haran and McConaughey website. Or go to bxcited.com/Fuji-Murakami/. Marvin Robbins, born October 22, 1936, and died February 13, 2022. Marvin died in his home in Denver, which he had lived in for over 60 years. He is survived by Mary, his wife of 50 years, daughters Julie and Jennifer, son Brian, and grandchildren Jacqueline and Trevor. He had a long career as a practicing psychiatrist, culminating in his role as medical director for the Aurora Mental Health Center. The family will hold a private memorial service at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be made to Caris Community, that is K-A-R-I-S, community.org. William Belter, Bill Shepherd, born November 5, 1930, and died on January 28, 2022. He was born to Gladys and Morton Shepherd in Danbury, Connecticut, and was the youngest of four brothers, Morton, George, and John, and the last to survive. He met his wife, Carol Brennan, when they were college sweethearts, and they married in 1955. His first trip to Colorado was taken by train to attend Colorado College, and then he attended Denver University for a master's. In the end, he succumbed to Parkinson's disease, passing away peacefully at home with his family by his side. He left behind all the ladies in his life, wife Carol, daughters Susan, Anne, and Jessica, granddaughters Audrey, Catherine, Grace, Caitlin, Carolyn, Hannah, and Kate, and great-granddaughters Frances and Cynthia. Shifting now to national news, truckers hold ground. Dateline Ottawa. Hundreds of truckers clogging the streets of Canada's capital stood their ground and defiantly blasted their horns Thursday as police poured in, threatening to break up the nearly three-week protest against the country's COVID-19 restrictions. Busloads of police arrived near Parliament Hill, and workers put up extra fences around government buildings. Police also began sealing off much of the downtown area to outsiders to prevent them from coming to the aid of the protesters. Police did make at least three arrests just before nightfall Thursday around Parliament Hill, but officers were not moving in force on the demonstrators. And Senate passes bill to avert a shutdown, Dateline Washington. The Senate gave final approval Thursday to legislation averting a weekend government shutdown, sending President Joe Biden a measure designed to give bipartisan bargainers more time to reach an overdue deal, financing federal agencies until fall. Final passage was by a bipartisan 65-27 vote, five more than the 60 votes needed. The House easily approved the legislation last week. Each party concluded an election year shutdown would be politically damaging. 19 police officers indicted in protest probe, Dateline Austin, Texas. A grand jury has indicted 19 police officers on charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon for their actions during 2020 protest over racial injustice that spread nationwide after the killing of George Floyd, according to people familiar with the matter. It ranks among the most indictments in a single police department in the U.S. over tactics used by officers during the widespread protest, methods that led to the resignation or ouster of several police chiefs across the country. Word of the indictments came hours after Austin city leaders approved paying $10 million to two people who were injured by police in the protest, including a college student who suffered brain damage after an officer shot him with a beanbag round. California adopts nation's first endemic virus policy, Dateline Sacramento, California. Governor Gavin Newsom announced the first shift by a state to an endemic approach to the coronavirus, which emphasizes prevention and quick reactions to outbreaks over mandates, a milestone nearly 2 years in the making that harkens to a return to a more normal existence. Newsom said the approach, which includes pushing back against false claims and other misinformation, means maintaining a wary watchfulness attuned to warning signs of the next deadly new surge or variant. And Brazil mudslide death toll is at 117. Dateline Petropolis, Brazil. The city's death toll from floods and landslides rose to at least 117 on Thursday, and local officials said it could rise sharply, with 116 more people still unaccounted for. And all of those briefs were from Denver Post Wire Services. Candy bomber who dropped sweets during Berlin airlift dies. U.S. military pilot Gail Halverson, known as the Candy Bomber for his candy airdrops during the Berlin airlift after World War II ended, has died at age 101. Halverson died Wednesday following a brief illness in his home state of Utah, surrounded by most of his children. James Stewart, the director of the Gail S. Halverson Aviation Education Foundation, said on Thursday. Halverson was beloved and venerated in Berlin, which he last visited in 2019 when the city celebrated the 70th anniversary of the day the Soviets lifted their post-World War II blockade, cutting off supplies to West Berlin with a big party at the former Tempelhof Airport in the German capital. Halvorsen's deeply human act has never been forgotten, Berlin Mayor Franziska Giffey said in a statement. Utah Governor Spencer Cox also praised Halvorsen, who was born in Salt Lake City but grew up on farms before getting his pilot's license. I know he's up there handing out candy behind the pearly gates somewhere, he said. Halvorsen trained as a fighter pilot and served as a transport pilot in the South Atlantic during World War II, before flying food and other supplies to West Berlin as part of the airlift. According to his account on the Foundation's website, Halvorsen had mixed feelings about the mission to help the United States' former enemy after losing friends during the war. But his attitude changed and his new mission was launched after meeting a group of children behind a fence at Tempelhof Airport. He offered them the two pieces of gum that he had broken in half and was touched to see those children who got the gum sharing pieces of the wrapper with the other children who smelled the paper. He promised to drop enough for all of them the following day as he flew, wiggling the wings of his plane as he flew over the airport, Halvorsen recalled. He started doing so regularly using his own candy ration with handkerchiefs as parachutes to carry them to the ground. Soon other pilots and chiefs joined in. After an Associated Press story, a wave of candy and handkerchief donations followed. Halvorsen's efforts to reach out to the people of Berlin helped send a message that they were not forgotten and would not be abandoned, Stewart said. A simple person-to-person act of kindness can really change the world, Stewart said. That's the news for today. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.